Good morning, councillors. The chair calls the second meeting of ALA Council to order. We will follow the same rules that were approved during the ALA Council 1 meeting. Again, as a courtesy to others, please turn off your cell phones or turn them to silent prompting. If you need to make or take a call, please leave the council chambers. Your voting record is at your place. You should have an ivory card for this morning's meetings. Please write your name and sign the card now. If you want to speak at this meeting, please go to a microphone, wait for recognition, then give your name and indicate if you are a division counselor, a chapter counselor, a counselor at large, or a roundtable counselor. Yesterday, I think we still had some trouble with the hearing each other with the microphones. Please don't think that the height of the microphone is set. You have permission to, instead of crawling on your knees if it's too short, you actually can raise it and then the next person will lower it if it's not convenient for you, and we'll wait. So don't feel like you're holding us up. It's fine. But we did learn that you have to speak directly into the microphone. We want to hear what you have to say. You will be asked to raise one of your hands for all votes that are not adopted by general consent. Only if the vote seems close will I call for a standing vote. If you must leave before adjournment, will you please turn in your voting card to Lois Ann Gregory Wood at the projectionist table over here. A quorum for a council meeting is 75 councillors, and I have been advised that we have well over 75, so we therefore have a quorum. The agenda, ALA Council Document Number 8.6, revised 6/29/14, 11:35 a.m. I'm used to that being very late, p.m. And all other documents issued since the last council meeting are available on ALA Connect and at the council document pickup station in this room. I would suggest that those of you who are on the agenda to report, please come up to the stage and sit beside Keith Michael Fields shortly before your presentation. This will enable us to move through the agenda more effectively. Thank you. Under the 24-hour rule, we have received the following resolutions to add under new business. ALA Council Document Number 45, Resolution on Granting the District of Columbia Government Budget Autonomy to allow city services, including libraries, to remain open during a federal government shutdown. Do you have any other new business to add? All right, hearing no new business, I declare that the agenda is adopted as presented. The chair directs you to ALA Council Document Number 17.1 and calls upon ALA Councillor William L. Bill Turner, Chair of the Policy Monitoring Committee, to present his report. Bill?
Good morning, everyone. It's my privilege and pleasure to give the report of the Policy Monitoring Committee. I would first like to note that the ALA Policy Manual is available online for reference at the URL stated there in the report. And give a reminder that the charge of the Policy Monitoring Committee is not to write policy or make policy or interpret policy. The committee's primary responsibility is upkeep of the manual. Now, the PMC has reviewed the actions of council from the 2014 ALA midwinter meeting in Philadelphia and has found one item that requires council action today, and that is improving member access to ALA governing unit information. The resolution at issue is one to improve member access to ALA unit governing information, and that is ALA Council Document Number 35, Revised 12614. And PMC moves that the text be incorporated into the policy manual as policy A.4.3.16.1. So you have the text there. I won't read it. It's verbatim, practically, the text that was in the resolution. We have edited it a little bit to make it fit, to make it flow, and we've assigned the heading Minutes of Meetings of Governing Units. So there it is for your approval.
Are there any questions for Bill? I'm sorry. Microphone 7.
Sorry. Karen Schneider, Councillor at Large. ALA hosted web page, does that include the concept of Connect? And are we asking people to post to Connect? Is that what we're saying?
Wait, say that again, please.
By ALA hosted web page, do you mean Connect?
Yes. Well, yes.
Okay.
That's correct.
I have noticed a number of documents that some documents still seem to be posted to the regular web pages, and some seem to be to Connect. I wouldn't want to make this so technically specific that in a year or two we have to revisit it, but I think if the idea is that we're supposed to be posting to Connect, we may want to ensure that that's what people are actually doing.
Okay. Thank you.
Microphone 4.
Al Kagan, CERT Counselor. Well, it wasn't my understanding when we passed this that it would be specifically to Connect. I thought it would be to any unit's web page, and we certainly have a lot of members that look at our web page that don't look at Connect. So I'm hoping that interpretation can be broadened out.
Okay. Lois Ann clarified that the policy is not specific, so it would, Al, apply to web pages that are hosted by the unit, which it says, but also ALA hosted web page, the access to Connect is through the ALA hosted web page. So it's comprehensive and not particular. Microphone 7.
Karen Schneider, Council at Large. So what we're saying is people don't actually have to post to Connect.
That's not what I just heard.
That's exactly what we're saying here. I just want to be
yes.
clear about that.
Yes.
And so it'll be the usual data kabobble of stuff here and there and here and there, and you're not really going to know where to find something. Because we've got, on the one hand, we have a commitment to always to use Connect, but on the other hand, we have a commitment to not always use Connect. Thanks.
Microphone 6.
Nick Buron, Council at Large. That's exactly what I think this is saying, is that if it does have to, if the idea is to put it all into one place, I think that it should be available in any of our divisions or roundtables' websites. However, if the intention is to put everything in one place, which I think was the intention when we were having this debate a while ago, that everything be in one place, that it happens to be the one-stop shopping right now is Connect, and that's what I'm reading from this. But the way this is being, but the way I read this means that it can go on somebody's roundtable webpage or division roundtable page and not be in Connect. And I think we had the debate one way or the other that we believe that it probably should all be in one place at some point.
I would just, before I call on the other councilors, I would just like to remind us that you've already passed this resolution, and the purpose of the Policy Monitoring Committee is to... What? Oh. All right. Okay. Sorry, I intruded. That the purpose of this is to just determine the place in the policies that this will take, that it will be placed. Yes.
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 Sure, Keith.
Keith?
When council met yesterday, I believe, we talked about a process for council documents in which they exist in draft form on Connect, but then there's a proviso that they then move over to the web. So I would agree at this point that we do not yet have the all in one place. The other question being, what does all in one place mean within a linked environment? So I would say there is some work ahead of us and that we're going to still have, I think, some different approaches. So for instance, if let's say CERC, just to take an example, were to post it on its website, would they have a link from Connect? If we're, as we put in searchability across Connect and the website, and you can do a search across both of those, does that make a difference? So I don't think that we've reached a conclusion, nor do I think trying to put everything in one place in a virtual environment. I think we need to just maybe discuss this a little bit, and that over the course of the next year or so, we may have a little more agreement as to what's the best method.
All right. Seeing no one else at the microphone, I call the vote. The resolution is PMC. C moves that the text be incorporated into the ALA policy manual as policy A.4.3.16.1. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Opposed? The motion passes. Please mark your ballot CD number 17.1. The next item on our agenda is...
Thank you very much.
Oh, I'm sorry, Bill.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I would like to thank the committee members for serving Henry Stewart and Jenny Taylor and our executive board liaison, John Mormon, and, of course, Lois Ann Gregory for her invaluable help as staff liaison. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. The next item on our agenda is recognition of retiring counselors and executive board members. We do have a photographer coming at 10 o'clock. So right now, we'll move to the recognition, but don't forget that at 10 o'clock, we will be breaking so we can get pictures of all of you all. I would like to acknowledge with thanks the ALA executive board members whose terms will expire with the adjournment of this conference. What I'm going to do is to read the names. Please, can you hold your applause and know that everybody will be equally recognized at the end. Maureen Sullivan, an ALA immediate past president. yeah. Dora Ho, executive board member. She was there. Where is she? There. She was elected counselor at large, so she will remain on council. Mike Marlin, ALA executive board member. He was and counselor at large. He was reelected counselor at large and will remain on council. Michael Porter, executive board member. Please also recognize our retiring counselors. They are Rosina Limo, Councillor at large, re-elected and will remain on council. Robert E. Banks, Rob, Kansas Chapter Councillor. Rob is also an executive board member and as such will remain on council. Daniel Berdaner, International Relations Roundtable Councillor. Mary Biblow, Councillor at large. Mary. Oh, she's at Ginny's. Yeah. Or she will recognize her when she comes back. This concludes Mary's 36th consecutive year on council. So we all need to give her a lot of honor when she rejoins us. Howard Boxenbaum, Rhode Island Chapter Councillor. Eileen K. Bosch, Councillor at Large. She's here. Oh, yes, stand up so we can see you. Irene L. Briggs, Councillor at Large. Yes. Diane R. Chen Kelly, Councillor at Large. Matthew P. Cizik, Councillor at Large, re-elected and will remain on council. Deidre Conkling, Councillor at Large. Sue Considine, Library Leadership and Management Association Councillor. Robert C. Delgadillo, Councillor at Large, re-elected and will remain on council. A number of these people really were conflicted because they have so much honor for Ginny Moore. And so please excuse anyone who's not here because it was very hard for some people not to honor Ginny by going to her presentation this morning. John C. DeSantis, Councillor at Large, re-elected and will remain on council. Brenda Ely, Nebraska Chapter Councillor. Jennifer Emanuel, Councillor at Large. Oh, there you are. Barbara L. Flynn, Councillor at Large. Angelica Fortin, Councillor at Large. Betsy Fraser, Councillor at Large. Ed Garcia Jr., Councillor at Large, re-elected and will remain on council. Christine Lind Haig, Public Library Association Councillor. Shelby E. Harkin, North Dakota Chapter Councillor. Luis Herrera, California Chapter Councillor. Mary Ann Hodell, Councillor at Large, re-elected and will remain on council. Patricia Hoffman, Maryland Chapter Councillor. David A. Hurley, Councillor at Large. Julius C. Jefferson Jr., Councillor at Large, re-elected and will remain on council. Wei Jiang Chu, Councillor at Large. Susan Jennings, New Members Roundtable Councillor, elected Councillor at Large, and will remain on council. Oh, there you are. Shidong Jean, Councillor at Large. I hope I didn't mess up too badly. Re-elected and will remain on council. Margaret L. Kirkpatrick, Councillor at Large. M. Claire Knowles, Councillor at Large, and re-elected and will remain on council. Alan Kornblau, Florida Chapter Councillor. Hannah Kyung Lee, Delaware Chapter Councillor. Marge Lockwaters, Wisconsin Chapter Councillor. There you are. Catherine Marriott, Counselor at Large. Kirby McGirdis, Counselor at Large. Barbara A. McDade, Maine Chapter Counselor. Bobby Newman, Counselor at Large. Andrew Pace, Andrew Pace, Counselor at Large, re-elected and will remain on Council. J.P. Porcaro, New Jersey Chapter Counselor. Brenda Pruitt Anisette, Counselor at Large, re-elected and will remain on Council. Nancy Ray, Massachusetts Chapter Counselor. Teresa Terry A. Reinheimer, Indiana Chapter Counselor. Zora J. Sampson, Counselor at Large. Jessica Scalf, Virginia Chapter Counselor. Julie A. Schneider, Counselor at Large. Brian Schottlander, Association for Library Collections and Technical Services Counselor. Wendy Stedman Stevens, Counselor at Large. Wendy. Holly A. Tomrin, Counselor at Large. William Bill Turner, Counselor at Large. Patricia A. Wand, Counselor at Large. And Andrew Wertheimer, Hawaii Chapter Counselor. Please, let's give all of them a great applause. Microphone four.
Mike Marlin, Executive Board. Just wanted to note that Mary Biblo was reelected and will remain on council, and we may be saying 39 years in a row at some point in the future.
Thank you for that clarification. Microphone three.
Larry Romans, Counselor at Large.
Really speak into the mic.
Okay, I couldn't get it to lift up. So. I'd like to mention that Margaret Kirkpatrick has been a counselor. You can't match Mary, but Margaret has been a counselor since at least 1992, and she's retiring this time.
Wow.
1985.
Thank you. Thank you, counselors. We will continue with our agenda and then come back for the picture at our break time. The chair directs you to ALA Council Document 27.1 and calls upon James R. Rettig, chair of the Committee on Organization, to present his report. Jim?
That's what my passport and driver's license say, but I'm just Jim. Good morning, Council. KU brings you two action items today. The first is probably somewhat familiar to you. It deals with the communication of ALA committees to members. And KU has operated under several assumptions. One is that members deserve access to information about what the committees who serve them are doing. Another is that a good way to do that is through regular written reports. And the third is that it's really a responsibility that belongs to the committee chairs of an ALA committee or a council committee. There's going to be a bit of real quick deja vu in this because it gets into the everything in one place issue, but we don't try to solve that. In summer a year ago, there was a KU action you approved of, but it was considered procedural and not policy. And we've also looked at the policy manual since then and discovered that it's very clear on requirements and expectations for members of committees, but there are no expectations stated for committee chairs. I guess all they have to do is show up. And we think that we need to clarify that they do have this responsibility on behalf of their committees to submit reports on a regular basis. So what we propose is that on page 2, action item number 1, that a new policy which addresses the responsibilities of committee chairs be adopted by council. So resolve that council approves as policy the following provision. Do you want me to read the whole thing?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Each chair of an ALA committee or a council committee is responsible for submitting to the ALA executive director at least 2 times each year a substantive report on the committee's work and accomplishments so that these reports can be made available to all interested ALA members. Such reports may address, but not be limited to, matters such as accomplishments, planned activities, issues that affect the committee's work and their implications for the future, interaction with other units within ALA, relationship of the committee's work to the ALA strategic plan, and current level of committee members' involvement, more substantive than an attendance role, and committee self-check on its value and viability. For example, update charge, discontinue committee, consolidate with another, change structure, other observations.
Is there any discussion on this resolution?
Barbara, may I make another comment?
Oh, yes, please.
It's my understanding that there was some discussion at the committee of the council forum last night about, well, what about a report to the council? Does that count as a report? Of course it counts as a report. And I am pretty sure that those reports reach the executive director. If you count on Lois Ann, and I know you do, the governance office has really good people in it. They'll communicate these things to one another when they come in.
Microphone number 6.
Nick Buron, Council at Large. I'm really sorry that it actually has to take an action by council to do this. That being said, mea culpa, I am not the best person at handing in my reports for my committees, and so I do thank you for the push, Jim. Thank you very much.
If there is no further discussion, I will call for a vote. Huh? Oh, I'm sorry. Microphone number 5.
Brian Chotlander, Lex Division Counselor. So I've seen a lot of reports in my 30 years at ALA. I don't think I've ever seen one that talks about the current level of committee members' involvement more substantive than an attendance role. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
The current policy, there are 2, I think it's 5.5 and 2 decimals, talk about committee membership, and they talk about participation, not attendance. Participation can take various forms, and this is an opportunity to discuss just within a committee, how are they participating? How are they doing their work? More and more is being done between meetings at annual and midwinter and being done using various online media. So there are opportunities to share that kind of information and, you know, just really take a pulse of is the committee functioning as a whole or is the weight being carried by the chair and one or two other people, as sometimes happens.
Microphone number 7.
Bernie Margolis, Counselor at Large. Jim, thank you, as always, for your wonderful work. Question I have, what's the penalty? And did you consider some penalty in this process? Are we going to publicly embarrass the chairs who don't submit their reports? Or Nick, you want to get up and... I'm asking this facetiously, but candidly, how can we get compliance with something that seems so basic to our professional skill set, and that is sharing information?
Well, Nick will be an exemplar. Thank you, Nick. At midwinter, we shared with you a procedural document that COO adopted on what would happen if 2 years elapsed, and there's been no evidence of a report from a committee. I was invited by the executive board to join them by telephone at their spring meeting to discuss this further. One of the questions that Koo had was, should we begin implementing this procedure based upon the data that we had that is posted somewhere on a big URL that tracks us for the last several years? Because there were several committees that fell into that category that we hadn't heard from, or there was no evidence that they'd been reporting for 2 years. Members of the executive board were able to verify that that wasn't the case in some of these. Just that last communication step. The big burden this puts on committee chairs is they have to send an email to the governance office saying, here's where to find our report. And so nothing has been done to implement that procedure. In brief, the procedure involves communication from the chair of COO to the chair of that committee saying, you're in arrears on your reporting. Please send documentation showing that you're still functioning and doing what you're supposed to be doing. And if that doesn't work, then they would, if the evidence is just insufficient to make the case that it's a viable committee, then they would be invited to meet with COO at the next annual or midwinter meeting and then make the case that, yes, this committee is really functioning. It's kind of like what academic institutions that fall into accreditation trouble are able to do. They get to make a documented case, and then they get to, well, some of them hire lawyers, or they get to have a face-to-face with the accrediting agency. It's not intended to be punitive. It's not out to get committees. It's to make sure that our organization has the organization it needs to have, and that these committees are contributing to that.
I would like to say that as a result of the executive board discussion, another reminder was sent out from the governance office, and that is a way that we prompt those committees to submit reports, and that was done. Microphone number 3.
Xu Dong, Jin, Councillor at Large. I would thank Jim and the committee to make this wonderful action item and with detailed information. I just have one question. If a committee has a motion item, do they report, do they list to those report, or do they just report to the ALA executive director directly?
Well, if a committee has an action item that is a policy matter, it has to come to this group for a decision. Council sets policy for the association. That report is a report. It would be wonderful if they expanded just beyond that one action item to talk about what they're doing, but it's not required in their council report. If they report to council, I am not going to submit another report to the executive director on what COO did in the last 6 months. This is it. And so that is the model for any report that comes to council. The governance office will identify that as a report from that committee. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah. Microphone number 5.
Olivia Madison, Councillor at Large. I would like to make an amendment to the action item, and it deals with the clause related to discussing the current level of committee members' involvement. I've been involved with ALA for a very, very long time, and I do not know how one would be able to, in any consistent fashion across all reports, be able to implement this clause. And I would like to move that the clause, current level of committee members' involvement, more than an attendance role, be removed and substituted with a text, a general description of committee members' involvement.
Do you have a second? Yeah. All right, what we really need is for you to hand that to Lois Ann, so that she can get it up on the screen. Thank you. And if you all will indulge me, I'm going to wait until it gets up on the screen. I think we're fine on time, so we'll be fine. Talk among yourselves.
So how are you doing? How are you doing?
I think you all understand the protocol that when something is put on the floor, that takes precedence. So I can't go on with other business, and so that's why if we can get the motions before you stand up to the mic, that helps. And I know a lot of times it's not possible, but I hope you understand why we need to wait. But we're close. Oh, we're there. All right. On the screen, can I call us back to order? Thank you. I didn't even have to. You already were. Note the deletion, and therefore it would read within ALA, relationship of the committee's work to the ALA strategic plan, a general description of committee member involvement, committee self-check on its value and viability. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Microphone number three.
Larry Romans, Counselor at Large. I oppose this. For one thing, I don't think it really says anything different than what is in the original. And the original doesn't say that you're going to go through each committee member and give them an A+ or a D-. But as someone who has been a committee chair on a number of occasions, I think that it's important not so much to say who's not doing their jobs, but in my case, in the resolutions committee, if somebody isn't a conference, they might as well not be on the committee, and I need to note that. But more importantly, if someone is doing a particularly good job, I want to make sure that the powers that be know that, so that that person may be considered for committee chair next time. So I think the way they've stated it, it serves us the best.
Microphone number seven.
Gina Persicini, Idaho Chapter Counselor, and also a member of CU, so I've had some discussion around this. I just wanted to point out that the sentence that we're talking about begins with the word "such reports may address," and may is a very important word. This is a suggestion, and while the I'm rather ambivalent about the proposal to change the wording, because I agree with Larry that it says the same thing to me, in my opinion. And I'm just not sure that this is necessary for any further clarification. The list of items that may be addressed could be included or not. It was just some suggestions to provide guidance to those writing the reports. And if it said shall, I will have a very strongly different opinion, but it says it may address, and to not necessarily limited to these items and not necessarily including those items. It's just a suggestion.
Microphone six.
I'm opposed to the change, particularly.
Would you
add? I'm Lauren Comito, Counselor at Large, sorry. I'm opposed to this change, particularly the part about taking a more substantive than an attendance role out. As we move to more virtual participation in committees, simply attending a meeting may not be the only participation someone has. Someone may be writing and contacting people and planning things and doing a lot of work virtually. And then, as for instance in my case, a younger member may not have the money to come to conference, but may be really willing to participate on a virtual level. I know we don't have virtual committee memberships, and I know people should probably manage to make it to conference, but sometimes things happen. And so just an attendance role isn't an accurate depiction of the amount of work someone's doing. Also, I think that it's not unreasonable to ask people, you know, are the people on a committee actually doing anything? Thank you.
If there is no further, microphone five.
Brian Schottlander, elects counselor. I appreciate Gail's observation that this long list of things follows an introductory phrase, may address. That's a useful reminder. The point that Olivia and I were simply trying to make revolves around the possessive members, plural. And everything that's been said in the room from Jim on is exactly what we would think would be appropriate in such a report. That's not exactly the way this reads, though. This sounds much more like Olivia didn't do anything the whole time she was on the committee. That's that member's involvement. So I just want you to understand the spirit of what we're talking about here. The general sort of description that I've heard you all talk about, Jim in particular, along the lines of, this committee might have been more effective had more than just the chair and vice chair actually done anything, we get. But the way this is articulated just worries us a little. I take the point about the attendance role. That's actually very important, and we agree with that.
If there is no further discussion, then I will proceed to a vote on the amendment. Note, the amendment includes deletion of some text and addition of alternative text. All those in favor of the amendment, please raise your hand. All those opposed, the motion fails. The amendment, yes. Mark your ballot, CD number 27.1, item 1. Amend. Microphone 4.
Jim Neal, member of the Executive Board. I have to say I'm quite bewildered by this proposal and by this conversation. My reading is this type of information, this type of directive has no place in an organization policy manual. This is procedure manual stuff. And it should be organized in a way to instruct organizations and units within the association how to carry out their work. It does not, in my view, belong in our policy manual.
And as Jim noted, we are now discussing the original resolution. Is there any further discussion on the original resolution? You see it before you on the screen. I won't ask Jim to read it again. Microphone number 3.
Deirdre Conkling, counselor at large. I always hate people that get up to the microphone and say, I agree, but nobody's saying anything. So I want to say I really agree with what Jim just said, that this is not something that belongs in the policy manual.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Microphone number 7.
Jennifer Boucher, WUSA counselor. I was wondering if Bill or Aaron or somebody who's very familiar with the policy manual, I've read certain parts of it, but not the parts, where would this fit within the policy manual? Is there a section for organizations or communication or is this really an outlier of what's in there right now? I'd like to hear that before I vote.
Is there anyone who would like to speak to that? Aaron? Microphone number 8.
Aaron Dobbs, Counselor at Large. I would actually defer to the Policy Monitoring Committee on that one.
Bill?
Or coup?
Microphone number 4.
Bill Turner, Councillor at Large and Policy Committee Chair. The committee would have to look at more detail into the Policy Monitoring Committee to see where the text would fit, so that if council passes the item at this meeting, then it would come to the Policy Monitoring Committee for the codification.
Thank you. Jim?
Middle of page 2 of the COO report notes that policy A5.5, there are two provisions there that address committee service. There is nothing in that section that addresses committee chairs and their responsibilities. I would suggest that that might be a good place to add this if it's approved.
Microphone 6.
Nick Buron, Councillor at Large. Although this does seem very lengthy for policy, and I do think it's one of these things that policy is mixing it with procedure in the same paragraph, it seems to me that it seems reasonable that this would be policy that if you are a chair of a committee, it is the policy of the library that you have to do a report. Everything else is the procedure of how to do it. However, I think this would fit in just fine into the policy.
If there is no further discussion, we will proceed to a vote on the original resolution, which you see before you on the screen. All those in favor, please raise your hand. All those opposed, please raise your hand. The motion passes. Please mark your ballot, CD number 27.1, item 1. Jim?
Okay, let me draw your attention out of the second part of the report. That deals with membership initiative groups and their longevity, their lifespan. This question came up during COO's meeting in Philadelphia, and we didn't have ready access to documents on the history of the creation of MIGS and such. The ever-capable governance office and Mary Geekus provided us with those important documents. What we found is that the assumption is that a membership initiative group is the term that we were perplexed by was short term. We understood the intent, but not what did short term mean in terms of length of time. And it turns out that as current policy has it, a MIG can come into being by petition of 100 members, and then 3 years later it can renew its existence for another 3 years. And then it has to either become something else or cease to exist. COO questioned why 6 years would be a maximum if it's a thriving group that's responding to member interests. So we have come up with a revision of the part of the policy that describes MIGS, which is policy 4.3.12, and it allows a MIG to renew its existence through repetition, following the same petition procedures and rules that govern its creation, after 3 years, and then again after another 3 years. It would also, at those points, or in your interim, have the option of trying to become a round table or something else, or it could inform COO that we're done, we should be disbanded. And so this proposal allows for a longer life than 6 years for a thriving MIG. So what COO recommends is action item 2 on page 4, if you want to follow along when I mispronounce something. Action item number 2, resolve that council approves as policy the following provision. And let me emphasize, this is a revision of existing policy, and the changes from the existing to what COO proposes is highlighted in the text above. A membership initiative group is formed when a group of ALA members identifies a common concern or interest about librarianship which falls outside the delegated responsibility of a single division, roundtable, or unit, and wishes to establish a short-term renewable mechanism to address this concern or interest. to establish a MIG, which must be approved by COO and reported to Council, a group must submit to the Committee on Organization a statement of purpose, at least 100 signatures of ALA members in good standing, and the names and addresses of the designated organizers. Once established, a MIG may operate for 3 years, at which point it may repetition for another 3-year term and may request an there's a word missing here, folks. Let me insert it. Or may request another place within the ALA structure by following the procedures for establishing that type of group, or may request the ALA coup to disband it. The repetitioning process can be renewed every 3 years.
Are there any questions? Microphone number 7.
Bernie Margolis, Councillor at Large. Could you give us some information on how many MIGs we have and how many have asked to be renewed or re-upped, and what the implication of this is for any of the existing MIGs? I mean, are they close to the process of seeking renewal?
Bernie, we had that question 2 days ago, and we don't yet have the answer. Carrie Price in the Governance Office has agreed she'll do some research to find out what the birth date was for the existing MIGs. There have been some who have been disbanded over time. We think there are a few that probably need to go through the repetition process, and COO will decide, you know, what a deadline for that should be for those that are not going to declare them defunct because they didn't do the repetition, because this hasn't been monitored with enough care to make that happen consistently.
Okay, second question.
And if you want the list of MIGs, there's the URL down right there under the information item.
Yes, I noticed that. Thank you. My second question is, why would a MIG need to ask ALA COO to disband? I mean, wouldn't the action of not asking for renewal be adequate enough? Why sort of impose another process on a group that obviously may be dying or not have a lot of interest in it? Why don't you just sort of leave it? It gets created for 3 years. You can renew it. If you don't renew it, it's dead, gone, kaput, right? Mr. Wheeler's
language. That would be the practical effect, but they could also make that request before that 3-year clock rolls around again. I could ask to be disbanded.
Okay. Thank you.
If there is no further discussion, we will proceed to the vote. You see the resolution on your screen. Resolve, the Council approves the following revision to ALA policy 8.4.3.12. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Opposed? The motion passes. Please mark your ballot CD number 27.1, item 2.
Do you want me to answer the question what the existing MIGs are?
Yes. I'll call on you in just a second. All right. Jim, some final words and information?
Councillor Margolis, I said earlier we can always count on Lois Ann. She has delivered to me the list of existing MIGs. The Diversity Membership Initiative Group, the Entrepreneurship and Makerspaces Member Interest Group, Graphic Novels and Comics and Libraries, Information Commons, Librarians Build Communities, which was approved this past spring, Libraries Foster Community Engagement, Nancy Cronick told me yesterday that's going to go through a name change probably, and Library Lab, Library Boing Boing, it changed its name after 1 year, and the Programming Librarian Interest Group, and the Virtual Communities and Libraries MIG. So those are our current MIGs.
Jim, any final words?
Over many years, I've had the privilege to be a member of Council, to be the presiding officer of Council, and to present things like this to Council. It's always been a pleasure, and you don't rush into decisions. You do a good job of drawing your conclusions and making your judgments, and it's always been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. The chair now directs you to ALA Council Document Number 22.1 and calls upon ALA Councilor Julius C. Jefferson, Jr., President of the Freedom to Read Foundation, to present his report. Julius?
Thank you. Good morning. As President of the Freedom to Read Foundation, it is my privilege to report on the Foundation's activities since the 2014 midwinter meeting. You have a very detailed report in front of you, so what I'm going to attempt to do is highlight a few items for you. First, I'm going to begin with litigation. Susan B. Anthony List versus Dryas. So the ALA and the Freedom to Read Foundation, along with several other organizations and booksellers, joined in filing an amicus brief to challenge censorship laws before an individual or institution is prosecuted for their speech, reaffirming the principle that persons who have a well-founded fear of prosecution under a law that infringes First Amendment rights should have standing to bring a pre-enforcement challenge to the law and not face a choice between engaging in self-censorship or risking criminal prosecution. So just a little background about Susan B. Anthony List, in case if you aren't aware. When this case came to us, I had to do research myself to understand exactly what Susan B. Anthony List was. So Susan B. Anthony List is an anti-abortion political action committee that challenged an Ohio false speech statute when it tried to post billboards attacking then U.S. Representative Steve Dryas in 2010. The plan ads accused him of supporting taxpayer-funded abortion with his vote for President Barack Obama's health care law. Dryas filed a formal complaint with the Ohio Elections Commission saying the ads misrepresented the facts and violated Ohio's false speech law. The billboard owner feared threatened legal action by Dryas and declined to post the ads. Dryas dropped the case after losing his reelection bid. So when Susan B. Anthony List challenged the law's constitutionality, a federal judge said the group didn't have the right to sue because the case had been dropped and the group hadn't suffered actual harm. An appeals court agreed, and the case was brought before the Supreme Court. On June 16, 2014, the Supreme Court held unanimously that Susan B. Anthony List indeed had standing to bring the pre-enforcement action and reiterated that, quote, a plaintiff satisfies the injury in fact requirement when he alleges an intention to engage in a course of conduct arguably affecting with a constitutional interest but prescribed by a statute, and there exists a credible threat of prosecution thereunder. The next case is a case that came before us before I brought this matter to you and reported this matter to you at midwinter. So this is Ark and Huppenthal, and I just want to provide an update on the case. So you may recall in my last report to this body, the case was about the elimination of Mexican-American studies classes and the banning of material in the Tucson Unified School District pursuant to an Arizona statute prohibiting the use of class materials or books that encourage the overthrow of the government, quote, promote resentment toward a race of class of people, are designed to designed primarily for the pupils of a particular ethnic group or advocate ethnic solidarity instead of the treatment of pupils as individuals. So in this case, and this is an interesting case, and I mentioned this before, but I just want to remind everyone that this case came to council through Reformer and other ethnic caucuses who approached IFC. IFC drafted a resolution and addressed the threats to intellectual freedom that restricted the access of educational materials. This body passed a resolution opposing restriction of access to materials and open inquiry in ethnic and cultural studies programs in Arizona. The Freedom to Read Foundation joined with ALA Reformer, the Black Caucus, APALA, filed an amicus brief in support of the students' First Amendment claims, and the Freedom to Read Foundation thanks ALA Reformer and others for their support. And I just want to let you know that this case is still pending before the Ninth Circuit Court. And this, again, is an example of how ALA, the membership, and the Freedom to Read Foundation supports the First Amendment rights. The next thing I want to talk about is education. So the Krug Fund, which was founded in the memory of the late Judith Krug, the founding director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom and the Freedom to Read Foundation, funds programs that focus on the education of librarians and the public on First Amendment rights. So the Krug Fund continues to focus on Banned Books Week
and awarded 7 grants to organizations that will celebrate books this fall. If you go to the FTR.org website, you'll be able to take a look at all the wonderful organizations that were able to receive this grant. In addition, the Krug Fund partnered with the Graduate School of Library and Information Sciences at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, to offer an online graduate-level course on intellectual freedom for LIS students around the country. This course, Intellectual Freedom and Censorship, is open to any student enrolled in an LIS program. It will be taught by Professor Emily Knox. Again, please go to the FTR website for more information about that. So I'm going to just point out one developing issue, one that I found very fascinating. So we discussed several issues, but one developing issue was about trigger warnings in colleges and universities. And this was pretty fascinating to me. Trigger warnings are disclaimers to alert readers that an article or a lecture contains potentially traumatic subject matter. These warnings are most commonly applied to discuss issues about rape, sexual abuse, and mental abuse. And in the discussion, we sort of came to the conclusion that this could be a new form of labeling, and we're definitely going to follow this very closely. Many of you who came to the opening general session heard that our 2014 Roll of Honor winner is Herb Krug, a founding member of the Freedom to Read Foundation, past treasurer and a current trustee and a faithful supporter and advocate for the Freedom to Read Foundation, and we certainly are proud of that and applaud him. I want to present to you our and announce to you that the Freedom to Read Foundation has named John Mack Freeman as the 7th recipient of the Gordon Conable Conference Scholarship. And Mack, as he's called, is back in the back. Please stand up, Mack, and be recognized. We anticipate that Mack will be very involved in intellectual freedom issues. Maybe one day Mac will be giving the report to you as the president of the Freedom to Read Foundation. So last on my list is, certainly not least on my list, is membership. We certainly want to continue to build the organizational capacity in order to support our litigation, education, and awareness campaigns. And to do this, your support is needed. So if you're not already a member of the Freedom to Read Foundation, as leaders of our association, I encourage you to join today. Join me in becoming a member and join today. You can always go online right now, if you have your computer with you or your cell phone, to the FTRF.org website. Or you can fill out an application. In the back, you can see Jonathan Kelly, who's in the back. Jonathan, wave your hand so they can see you, so they can pay their dues to you today. We would be happy to have you be a member and join us at the Freedom to Read Foundation. So that concludes my report, and if there are any questions, I'll take it now.
Are there any questions? Microphone 3.
Hi, Loida Garcia Fibo, Councilor at Large. On behalf of Reforma, and I would like to thank the FTRF and Council for the continued support to ensure access to information for all in our communities. And let's continue monitoring the case in Tucson, because it's not over. Thank you.
Any other questions? In that case, thank you very much on behalf of all of us for the work of the Freedom to Read Foundation. I think we have time to take up our new business item before our break. We're trying to time it at 10 o'clock for the photographer. I know he is, okay. So we have one more item on our agenda, and that's new business. I would like to move us to that, and then when we take a break, we will have ended this council session. So Christopher Corrigan is at microphone 4, and he will read only the resolved clause of ALA Council Document Number 45, Resolution on Granting the District of Columbia Government Budget Autonomy, District of Columbia Budget autonomy to allow city services, including libraries, to remain open during a federal government shutdown. Sorry, I messed that up. Microphone four.
Good morning. Can everyone hear me? Okay. Resolve that, Chris Corrigan, DCLA chapter counselor, resolve that the American Library Association urges Congress to grant the District of Columbia budget autonomy in order to prevent the unnecessary closure of city government facilities, including public libraries, in the event of a federal government shutdown.
Would you like to speak to your motion?
Yes, ma'am. Before I begin, I want to clarify that the Committee on Legislation has endorsed this resolution. The only reason that they are not listed is because of an issue of timing. In addition, as a federal librarian, I feel obligated to say that I'm bringing this resolution on behalf of DCLA, and that what I say here are DCLA's views and the opinions and don't necessarily reflect those of my employer, nor does my employer endorse this resolution. That said... That said, let me begin by stating what this resolution is not. This is not a call for D.C. statehood. This is not a call to have voting representation in Congress. This is not asking Congress to relinquish their constitutional authority over the District of Columbia. To the contrary, it is asking Congress to use that constitutional authority to grant the government of the District of Columbia budget autonomy from the federal government. ALA should take a position on this issue because currently D.C.'s inability to spend locally raised taxpayer dollars without authorization from Congress puts D.C.'s public libraries service in jeopardy. If Mayor Gray had not taken the unprecedented action of declaring all D.C. employees essential, then city services, including the 26 branches of the D.C. Public Library, would have closed for the duration of the federal government shutdown. This is despite the fact that D.C. had passed their budget and D.C. employees are not federal employees. Had the shutdown occurred, people with disabilities would have been blocked from accessing the State Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. It would have prohibited patrons from accessing GED training and ESL instruction from the Adult Literacy Department. It would have ended the library's early childhood literacy campaign, and it would have blocked access to free drop-in job seekers clinics for patrons looking for assistance in filling out a resume or applying for a job online. By the numbers, it would have prevented 2,000 children and teens from obtaining library cards, nearly 23,000 children from receiving access to programming, 1,600 students would not have been able to attend the library's free classes, and 35,000 people would not have been able
Chris,
to...
Chris, go just a little bit slower. We
oh,
have
I'm
time,
sorry.
But Heather is having a little oh. bit of trouble keeping up with you.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, so would not 35,000 people would not have been able to meet in the library's 90 free meeting rooms. What is more, had Mayor Gray not acted, then 700 library employees, your colleagues, would have been furloughed without pay. What Mayor Gray did was a heroic act. However, this past April, he lost the Democratic primary, and his term will end in January. At this point, it is unclear, should another federal government shutdown occur, that his successor would follow his actions, as the city's reserve fund used to pay employees was nearly depleted. The next mayor should not have to make this kind of decision because D.C. and the people who live there did nothing to deserve this kind of fiscal purgatory. I should also mention that this is an achievable goal. It is encouraging that Republican Congressman Daryl Issa has written legislation that would amend the D.C. Home Rule Act, allowing for D.C. to spend its own funds without authorization from Congress. DCLA is really pleased to hear this because as long as D.C.'s budget is tied to the federal government's, the city's services to D.C.'s nearly 700,000 residents through their public library remains in jeopardy. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Microphone number six.
Sue Kam, Councillor at Large. I applaud the makers of the resolution for bringing this before council, but I'm just wondering who the resolution is meant for. Is it meant for members of Congress? Is it meant for the D.C. City Council, or who?
The resolution
Microphone
states,
number four.
So, Chris Corrigan, DCLA chapter counselor. The resolution states that it urges Congress, so it's meant for Congress. Thank you.
Microphone number four.
Al Kagan, CERT counselor. Just want to tell you that the CERT Action Council has endorsed this resolution.
Microphone number seven.
Jennifer Bocher, RUSA counselor. I just wanted to be informed that RUSA Executive Committee has reviewed this and also agrees with it, endorses it.
Microphone number three.
Pat Wan, Councillor at Large. As a resident of the District of Columbia metropolitan area, I will be voting in favor of this. I know how important it is, having lived through the sequestration of last fall. So it's very important, I believe, for library services.
Microphone number four.
Bill Turner, Councillor at Large and native of Washington, D.C., and member of the D.C. Library Association and librarian with the D.C. Public Library. And clearly, the citizens of D.C. suffer undue deprivation when the library closes due to a shutdown. And I would just point out that Chris's resolution is consistent with the ALA core organizational values in extending and expanding, and in this case, maintaining library services in America and around the world. It's consistent with the key action area of equitable access to information and library services, in that ALA advocates funding and policies that support libraries as great democratic institutions. And finally, it's consistent with the goal area of advocacy, funding, and public policy. So I would support this resolution. Thank you.
Microphone number six.
Pat Hoffman, Maryland Chapter Counselor. I am absolutely in favor of this resolution as a neighbor of D.C., and our area is very affected by shutdowns. Thank you.
Microphone number seven.
Wanda Dole, Library Research Roundtable Counselor, speaking on behalf of the Roundtable to endorse this.
Thank you. Microphone number three.
Liz Bischoff, ASCLA Counselor. Chris presented this resolution to the ASCLA board. We discussed it, and the board has asked me to endorse this resolution.
Is there any further discussion? Microphone number four.
Chris Corrigan, again, DCLA chapter counselor. And I should mention that no one writes a resolution, especially his first one, like this alone. The statistics were provided by the new director of the D.C. Public Library, Richard Reyes-Gavilan, and Rachel Hawthorne, a member of his staff. In addition, whether or not this passes, I am incredibly grateful for the mentorship and assistance I received from Julius Jefferson, Pat Wan, Jennifer Bocher, Larry Romans, Ellie, Lois Ann, of course, and Danielle, Bill Sutiff, Daniel Corwell, Mike Marlin, Vivian Nguyen, and the entire Committee on Legislation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We will now proceed to the vote. Resolve that the American Library Association urges Congress to grant the District of Columbia budget autonomy in order to prevent the unnecessary closing of city government facilities, including public libraries, in the event of a federal government shutdown. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Opposed? The motion passes. Mark your ballot, CD number 45. All right, I have a couple of things I'd like to say before we conclude. First of all, I needed to say, and did not say, those of you all who are retiring counselors, you can pick up your certificates over at the pickup station, and please do. It's a wonderful thing to be able to display a physical documentation of your great service, so we appreciate you. I also would like to say that in preparation for tomorrow, we had space today. We're going to end early. Tomorrow we have an hour and a half, and we have some substantive issues coming before us, important reports. Please, if you will do any kind of preparation that you can beforehand, if you think you're going to ask for, we'll get those documents, I assume, as soon as they're available. The committees are meeting this afternoon and fine-tuning, so you'll probably, like last night, we got the Connect site. We'll get it tonight, so stay up till midnight. Read them. Take a resolution form home to your hotel with you if you think you're going to ask for it, so we don't have to wait at all. And we will need to move along. So if you come up to the microphone, if you will state your point and sit down, you don't have to use all 3 minutes. So we just need to move it along because I don't want somebody to be bumped off and not give good consideration of anything because we run out of time. And it's a hard deadline tomorrow, so we can't extend. I now call upon Keith Michael Fields, ALA Executive Director and Secretary to the ALA Council, for announcements. Keith?
Great. I'll just report on attendance. As of yesterday, at the end of the day, we had a grand total of 12,806 registrants and 5,588 exhibitors for a grand total of 18,396 attendees. That is obviously a little lower than the 21,000 we had in Chicago last year, but it is higher than the 17,655 that we had at Anaheim. And just a note on these numbers. When we looked at this conference, we modeled it on Anaheim. I think it's very encouraging to see that the number of advanced registrants was significantly higher coming in. Anyone who's looked out of the window of their hotel will note that the place for people to drive in from are somewhat lacking surrounding this area. So we did have a significant on-site registration in Anaheim, which we have not had here. We had about 221. All in all, I think it's been a very successful conference from an attendance standpoint. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith. The photographer for those retiring counselors, and even if you've been reelected, you're supposed to be in the picture. So he's out in the hall and he's all set up. And also I want to remind all of you all to vote. And you can still vote at the pickup table over here. Microphone number 7.
Aaron Dobbs, Councilor Large, Acting Interim Forum Convener. To remind you that tonight at 8:30 in Ballroom F of the Las Vegas Hotel, we have Council Forum. Last night was very pleasant, and I'd love to see you there again tonight. And anyone who didn't show, please consider coming. Thank you.
Please pass your signed voting record cards. Microphone number 5, and then I will get back. Y'all, we haven't adjourned yet. Attention to microphone number 5.
Pam Hickson Stevenson, Ohio Chapter Counselor, Chapter Counselors Forum, today, 4 to 5:30, LVH, Pavilion 4, open to all.
Thank you. Please pass your signed voting cards to the aisles for collection. Please be sure that you have signed them. It's very important, and your ballot will be voided. If there is no objection, I declare the second meeting of council adjourned.